Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's Christmas. We're going to mark the day with the music of ancient wooden horns called serpents. We'll also have the latest news at the half hour. But we want to start with a conversation with three wise men, a Sufi Muslim sheikh, a reform rabbi, and a United Church of Christ minister. Together, they directly confront the delicate issues that divide people on their own radio show, in a recently released book, and in appearances across the country, during which they answer questions about their faiths and ask a few themselves. Sheikh Jamal Rahman is grateful for the spirituality of Islam, but uncomfortable with the verses of the Quran that advocate killing unbelievers, especially when those verses are taken out of context. Rabbi Ted Falcon values the Judaic principle that every person is holy, but finds the violence in the Old Testament unsettling. And Pastor Don McKenzie says Christianity is about unconditional love. He's uncomfortable with prohibitions against divorce, homosexuality, or the attitudes towards Jews in the New Testament. The three call themselves the Interfaith Amigos. They are based in Seattle. We found them at the studios of KUOW, waiting for our call.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. La ilaha illallahu. La ilaha illallahu.
Hello?
Hi, Robin.
Hi.
We're just vocalizing ourselves.
Sorry to interrupt.
Signature song.
What was that?
It was it's actually a song that combines Arabic, Hebrew, and English. We based it on a Sufi chant and then added a Hebrew line and an English line.
And the words are, in the name of God who is boundlessly compassionate and merciful, there is no reality but one reality. And there's a Hebrew part to it.
The absolute transcendent one awakens within each one of us as our God. That is the one. And the English is...
The English is, it's all one and I am as I am.
It's our signature song. Wherever we go for events, we at the end sing that together.
I thought you were going to say, people call out for it. sing your Sufi song.
Not yet.
No, if we have plants in the audience, they do, but otherwise, no.
Well, thank you so much for letting us hear it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And should I say Merry Christmas? Sheikh Rahman, or I should say Sheikh Jamal, you like to be called by your first names.
Oh,
and,
please, yes.
Yep, and Rabbi Ted, you know, this is something that divides people right now. There are people who find it offensive to be saluted that way on a day they don't celebrate, and there are people who find it offensive that anyone else finds it offensive. So
right. You're
a rabbi. What do you say?
I say Merry Christmas. It's a day of celebration. It's a day of opening hearts. It is true that for many in the Christian community, it is a deeply religious holiday. But for a multitude of Americans, it's a family day. It's a heart-opening day. It's a day of getting closer. And I think that can be celebrated by all of us.
Pastor Don?
You know, I think for Christians, it does come as a surprise initially to realize that there are people for whom the greeting Merry Christmas is not pleasant. And Ted and Jamal were at my house the other day, and we have a Christmas tree, and I pointed to it, and I said, that Christmas tree in some ways represents a dramatic continuum between some of the things that are the most precious to me and some of the things that are the most hateful to me, namely that Christmas for me, as a child especially, was a time that felt more inclusive as a moment in time than almost anything else. And it was a shock to realize later in my life that there were people who did not feel they could be included in that moment of inclusion.
Sheikh Jamal?
Yes. And you know, many non-Muslims do not know that Jesus is very, very deeply revered in the Quran. So the truth is, most Muslims, in fact, all Muslims, because the Quran says so, believe in Jesus as a very profound prophet who in the Quran is called Ruh Allah, Spirit of God. So Muslims have a genuine, heartfelt love for Jesus and also for Mary, who is called the holiest of the holy among women. And she has an entire separate chapter in the Quran. And the Quran says, if somebody greets you, please greet even with greater fervor, increase upon that greeting. So if someone greets me with Happy Christmas, I with the utmost sincerity will also greet the person and say, Happy Christmas.
Or Happier Christmas.
Happier Christmas, that's right. By manyfold.
One of them. Well, you've just told us something that you want people to know about your faith, and that's part of, you know, what you guys do through your work. It's not like it's always kumbaya with you guys. When you were writing your book, I read in the New York Times that there was a line that Sheikh Jamal, you put in about the security wall that was built by Israel in Jerusalem.
Yes.
And Rabbi Ted, well, there was like a hissy fit there. What did you say?
We prefer to think of it as a major fight between alpha males rather than a hissy fight. But
Because you said what?
I said if that line is in the book, then I'm not in the book.
What was the line?
The way I read the line, it put all the responsibility for the construction of that wall on Israel without any recognition that there was a shared responsibility in creating the circumstances that led to its building.
So, Sheikh Jamal, you've got your friend Rabbi Ted drawing a line in the sand.
Yes.
How do you respond to that?
This is the beautiful insight from the Quran for me that, you see, the real work is to get to know the other. If we are good friends, then no matter what the differences are, it doesn't loom as a threat anymore. See, that was Brother Ted's perception of what I wrote, and I had a different perception of what I wrote.
This is Rabbi Ted. You can also hear some of the differences between us, because I am quick to react, and Jamal is far more diplomatic.
But Ted is very gracious, let me tell you.
for example, when we were talking about Israel, my perception is that Israel is a small sliver of land caught in a sea of Arab countries. So I perceive a country that is always under threat. Jamal perceives
Israel as a huge military machine enjoined by all the resources of the Pentagon. So it's a really monstrous killing machine available there, you see?
So that's a big difference of opinion.
So it's a difference of perception.
It's a difference of perception. It really is. It's a difference of perception and the beliefs that follow that perception.
But, you know, most people who have that difference, and it's a common one, they aren't able to, you know, travel the country and go on radio shows and write books together. You know, how do you help them?
Okay, so this is exactly to the point of the work we're doing. The essential message is all our traditions are avenues to something greater, and that something greater unites us on the other side of the disagreements, on the other side of the incompatibilities. There is something greater happening, and unless we tap into that, our world is not going to survive. We need to find ways to unite all of us. And we're not saying that spirituality coming from each of our traditions is the only way, but we are saying it is one of the ways.
That's Rabbi Ted Falcon. He and Sheikh Jamal Rahman are talking about a disagreement they had while writing the book, Getting to the Heart of Interfaith. You both ultimately came to an understanding. Sheikh Jamal changed the line to something you were both comfortable with. But I'm wondering, Pastor Don McKenzie, the third amigo in Seattle's Interfaith Amigos, while this spat was going on, what were you thinking?
From my point of view, I thought, this is the end. You know, we've reached that place that often interfaith dialogue gets to and can't go any further. And we were silent. And then, you know, as we started to come out of that and say, what's going on here, we realized that it was an opportunity to ask what it felt like to be Jamal, what it felt like to be Ted. It's not just the facts of a tradition or even the history of it, but the ways in which a person's life story, whatever that might be, and a person's beliefs, whatever they might be, how do those things fit together?
Father Tom Ryan, who's director of the Paulist Office for Interfaith Relations in D.C., in reviewing your book, wondered if what you're doing might lead to a blending of faiths, which he doesn't advocate. He's a Catholic priest. He says, no, there are differences, and we've got to adhere to them. Or to underscore it even more, some people worry about Christmaska, you know, some blending of Hanukkah and Christmas. And people worry about that.
That's natural. I think that is a natural fear some people have when they hear the word interfaith, that they will be required to let go of or lose something that's dear to them. And I'd say at one level we agree with Father Tom Ryan. We're not about blending. We're not about homogenizing. In fact, we're saying we each have different things to contribute to the common good. And learning about what those are is a source of growth for us.
But you ask people to do more than learn. You want them to literally explore other faiths' spiritual practices, be in each other's shoes. So here it is, Christmas. Rabbi Ted, Sheikh Jamal, have you ever explored celebrating Christmas?
You know, in most Muslim countries, Christmas is actually a holiday. So in the Muslim countries, they are celebrating the fact that they love Prophet Jesus so profoundly, so exquisitely. Out of love for the Prophet, they also join in the celebration.
As you said, he's mentioned in the Quran.
Mentioned the Quran as a spirit of God, as one who is closest to God in this world and the next world. I just want to make one very central point, and it relates to Christmas. We have a mantra, we say, interfaith is not about conversion. It's about completion, about becoming a more complete human being. So I, as a Muslim, when I celebrate Hanukkah or Christmas, this does not diminish me as a Muslim or as a human being. It actually enriches me, ennobles me, and allows me to go deeper into my own Islamic faith.
Rabbi Ted, how about you?
My wife, Ruth Newald Falcon, and I went to a holiday concert, essentially a Christmas concert. We were thinking about exactly the question you are asking. You know, to what degree can we enter into a celebration of Christmas? And certainly, if it is celebrating a birthing of hope, a birthing of possibility, if it is pointing to a universal that, in fact, is reflected in all traditions, then it's easier for us to enter into that celebration. When it is celebrating more specifically the birth of the Savior, God becoming human, then that's not a context in which we can personally celebrate, we can support, you know, we can encourage others for whom that is their faith to enter into a heart-opening celebration, but it's not ours to be able to celebrate.
And I think the challenge for Christians is to keep what Ted just said in mind, that at a Christmas Eve service, for example, it's important to see what's happening at Christmas as something that really points to the universal, that we're all on the way to something that is healing. Then we've got something very important that can mean a lot.
That's Pastor Don McKenzie with Rabbi Ted Falcon and Sheikh Jamal Rahman. They are the Interfaith Amigos. To learn more about their radio show or their book, go to our website, herenow.org. I want to wish you all a very, very Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
Happy New Year. Lots of love.
Happy Eid. Happy Hanukkah. Happy life.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Bailout was the 2008 winner. Subprime won in 2007. Remember when Pluto was demoted from planet status? Well, Being Plutoed won in 2006. And then there was Truthiness, Stephen Colbert's delicious 2005 word. They are all past winners of the American Dialect Society's Word of the Year Award. What will it be this year? Or as 2010 approaches, what about the word of the decade? Ben Zimmer is executive producer of the Visual Thesaurus and a member of the Executive Council of the American Dialect Society. He joins us from the studios of NPR in New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's get right to it. I'm looking at your list. Tick them off for us.
Well, we've got a whole range of different things that we were talking about this year. We had political words and phrases, things like death panel to public option when we were talking about the healthcare debate, to other things that had to do with particular news stories that caught our interest, everything from Balloon Boy to Octomom. So many of these have to do just with one particular thing, you know, we might be talking about, but it's really just tied to that story. And once people forget about that, they forget about the words. So, you know, right now, maybe we might be talking about Gate Crasher Gate, when the Salahis crashed the state dinner for Obama. Some people have even turned Salahi into a verb, meaning to gate crash an official event. But it's hard to really see that having a lot of staying power.
I'm looking at other phrases that will, though. Shovel ready, you know, infrastructure projects that are ready to go for stimulus money. You know, shovel ready is a good phrase that can have a long life. But another one might be mini Madoff. What's that?
A mini Madoff would be somebody who perpetrates a Ponzi scheme or some other financial scam, but on a smaller scale than Bernie Madoff. So there the name Madoff has been spun off into all these mini Madoffs who might not be doing this kind of scheming on quite the same level as him.
Well, and another one that could be a great euphemism, hiking the Appalachian Trail.
Yes, in fact, we're going to be voting in various different categories for the American Dialect Society, not just for Word of the Year, but for many other categories like most useful, most likely to succeed. And we do have a category for most euphemistic. I think that hiking the Appalachian Trail, which was the alibi we all remember that Governor Mark Sanford used to cover up his trip to Argentina to see his mistress, I think that's a front runner for most euphemistic term of the year.
Playing golf might be another one, but that's okay. Well, Oxford University Press has already selected their word of the year. It's unfriend, you know, when you delete somebody from your social network site. What do you think of that?
I think that's a great choice, and in fact, it shows a lot of the creativity of language. We see that the un prefix, which is a very old prefix, can be used to mean to undo some sort of action. So you can unfriend, you could also unfollow someone, you could unfavorite something. And so we can see that this very old prefix ends up getting used in lots of new ways as people are finding new actions that they want to take back on social media sites like Facebook or Twitter. Twitter itself has generated lots of new vocabulary, and in fact, it's generated its own new prefix. TW, twa, can be attached to all sorts of words. So you can talk about tweeps or tweeple, or you could talk about an interview conducted over Twitter would be a Twinterview. So these are all new aspects of what they call the Twitterverse, the universe of Twitter.
Oh, boy. It being the end of the decade, do you have a front runner for the whole decade?
There are some obvious front runners, I think. It's hard to dispute the success of a word like blog, which was a very new word at the beginning of the decade, and it is now everywhere. We have Google used as a verb. And, you know, those are pretty obvious candidates that have really taken off. Also from the beginning of the decade, obviously 9/11, a number, but used as a word has had a huge impact.
Right.
And even a common word like green, when used in all sorts of different ways, combining with other words to describe environmental aspects of different things, green has been used as this very productive combining form.
Green has become a verb.
That's right.
To green something. Ben Zimmer, executive producer of the Visual Thesaurus and a member of the Executive Council of the American Dialect Society. When are you going to announce the word of the decade or year?
January 8th, we'll be voting in Baltimore and we'll make our announcement.
We will be on the edge of our seats. Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And before we take a break, a quick note, or several, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, or ASCAP, has released its top holiday songs of the decade, meaning the most popular versions of the titles heard most often on radio and TV. Here are the top five. At number five, Santa Claus is Coming to Town, written in 1934, but heard most often this past decade by Bruce Springsteen.
He's making a list, he's checking it twice.
Number four, another relatively modern take on an oldie. It was first heard in the 1944 film Meet Me in St. Louis, sung by Judy Garland. This decade, Chrissy Hynde and the Pretenders' 1987 version of Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas made it to ASCAP's list.
Through the years, we all will be together. If the fates align, hang a shining star upon the highest bough.
The tune Sleigh Ride was written as an instrumental and first performed by the Boston Pops in 1948. Lyrics were added in 1949. It clocks in at number three, recorded by the Ronettes.
Just see those sleigh bells jingle and ring, tingle, tingle.
Number two, The Christmas Song, Nat King Cole.
chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
And the number one most heard holiday song of the past decade, the 1934 classic Winter Wonderland, but the most popular version came from the Eurythmics, Annie Lennox and Dave Stewart. Later today, the real Sherlock Holmes, back after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. General Motors and Chrysler took billions in bailout money, but they're still struggling to stay afloat. Industry analysts say they need new vehicles, but also aggressive marketing. And that's why a new ad from Chrysler has them scratching their heads. It features former Nobel Peace Prize winners Lech Wałęsa and Mikhail Gorbachev alighting from Chrysler's, making a plea to free fellow Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, who's been under house arrest in Myanmar for most of the last 20 years.
Because freedom always finds a path to build peace.
Well, as noble as Nobel Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi is, why is she the centerpiece of a campaign for a company that once featured American guru Lee Iacocca? Let's ask Here Now media analyst and Boston University mass communication professor John Carroll. And John, we're guessing one answer is where this ad came from. Explain.
This ad came from Fiat, which owns Chrysler now. They had created it to coincide with the 10th World Summit of Nobel Peace Laureates that was held in Berlin last month. It was for their Lancia model, and what they did was they refashioned it for the U.S. market.
Right. So it was made originally by an Italian ad agency in Italy and then just sort of refashioned for the U.S. LA Times reporter Dan Neal writes, most Americans wouldn't know Suu Kyi if she lobbed a grenade at them, which, of course, we will add, she wouldn't, Peace Prize winner, saying, you know, this makes no sense for an American audience. So what do you think of the strategy?
Well, I think what they've done is they've taken a European sensibility and transplanted it to the U.S., and I think they've overestimated the knowledge of the American public about current events, and what they want to do is change the image of Chrysler. And in a way, it may be an attempt to be what they call a news ad, which is an ad that you buy a little bit of media time for, but essentially hope that the media coverage will give you a big bounce.
Well, and here we are doing just right. That. But also, I don't know if it's such a bad strategy because we all talked about it in the office. Did you see that ad? Well, that's so interesting. Why would they do that? And maybe they're not giving Americans enough credit. But Dan Neal also says it's noble and beautiful to watch from a safe distance. There's not a lot of chance of blowback. There's not a lot of chance that there are going to be people outraged over this or on either side of this issue in the United States.
No, and I think it's a placeholder in a lot of ways. I think Fiat has to figure out what are they going to do with Chrysler? How are they going to position Chrysler going forward? Because Chrysler's image right now is pretty dismal.
There are other ramifications, though, of Chrysler getting an ad on the cheap from Italy. Because when Fiat bought Chrysler, they fired the Detroit area ad firm BBD&O. You first alerted us to this. BBD&O had signed a contract to only work for Chrysler. What's been the effect of them being fired?
Up to 500 people in Detroit have lost their jobs at this point. And this is bad PR for Chrysler because there are two things. One is they have used U.S. taxpayer bailout money to pay an Italian agency for ad work.
Although they say not a lot. Again, it was recycled. But
not a lot. Yeah. But and they've also withdrawn jobs from the Detroit market, right, which is hurting.
Because not only did 485 people lose their jobs, which is, it's astonishing to think that's how many people it takes, you know, to do one car company's ads. But Chrysler owed BBD&O $58 million when they fired them, and that $58 million bill gets wiped clean because of the bankruptcy. So they were left holding the bag, too. Well, just one last question, John Carroll. Jeep, which is one of Chrysler's best-selling brands, saw its sales drop last month. Now, a smaller Michigan ad firm has picked up that account. Their new ad campaign is the one that says, I live, I ride, I am, Jeep, you know, with various people, you know, with their dogs and such. The Chicago Sun-Times called it a new low in the world of consumer advertising. Why? You know, I didn't hate it. Why is it so bad?
I think part of it is the sort of pretentiousness of it. You know, I Jeep, therefore I am. It's a sort of Cartesian approach to advertising. And I think Jeep in general has an image of being sort of overblown and outsized in its own image. So I think what's happening here is these kinds of ads, which try to be meaningful, try to have some kind of significance to people, try to talk about lifestyles and
values,
that kind of thing. I think that those can come off well. Chevy, for instance, does a lot of very patriotic, flag-waving, American-themed ads, or they can come off as pretentious, and I think that that's where the Jeep ad came off.
Back to the drawing board, maybe. Here now, media analyst and Boston University mass communication professor John Carroll. To read his blog about media and politics, Campaign Outsider, go to our website, hereandnow.org. John, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Up next, taking many pages from Sherlock Holmes, and before we go today, the ancient wooden horn, the serpent. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back. Beginning today, movie audiences get their chance to see the latest incarnation of that master detective, Sherlock Holmes, with Robert Downey Jr. as Holmes, Jude Law as his loyal, if long-suffering, sidekick and chronicler, Dr. Watson.
I am psychologically disturbed.
How so?
Why else would I continually be led into situations where you deliberately withhold your plans from me?
You never complained about my methods before.
I never complain. When do I complain about you practicing the violin at 3 a.m? Or your mess? Your general lack of hygiene? Or the fact that you steal my clothes?
It's been over 120 years since Sir Arthur Conan Doyle introduced Sherlock Holmes, and our next guest says you can draw a line straight from Holmes to TV shows like House and the forensic crime drama CSI. Ransom Riggs, yes, that's his real name, is the author of the Sherlock Holmes Handbook, The Methods and Mysteries of the World's Greatest Detective. I told him my image of Holmes was Basil Rathbone, proper, calculating, and asked, was that how Holmes' creator, Arthur Conan Doyle, saw him?
The movie versions of the Holmes stories started to come out when Doyle was still alive, and initially he was surprised to see that they had cast the sort of, you know, these handsome guys to play Holmes, because he's not described as a handsome, dashing person in the stories. He's described as the sort of hawk-nosed, beady-eyed man of piercing intelligence. But Doyle said, you know, well, it's probably better for the ladies. It'll help it'll help my audience.
Even though he didn't seem that interested in the ladies, there was one woman who outwitted him. That's Irene Adler. But is he cast as a romantic?
No. He's often portrayed as basically emotionless, a sort of calculating machine. You know, Watson's always talking about how Holmes is pure reason, and he abhors the softer emotions, and there's a line where he says, Holmes loathed society with his whole bohemian soul. So he's often portrayed as this total misanthrope. There's a story late in the canon where Watson's being attacked, and Holmes leaps to his defense and shoots this attacker, and sort of heartwarmingly comes to his friend's aid and is sort of bent over him and saying, are you okay? Are you okay? And Watson writes that, you know, for the first time he really realized that this was a man of heart and not just of brain.
He does drugs.
He talks about it as really just a coping mechanism for having nothing to do. His mind is so powerful that when it doesn't have an interesting case to occupy it, it racks itself to pieces. As we see in The Sign of Four, Holmes talks about not only why he depends on drugs sometimes, but why he chose his career. The way his mind works really drove him to the career that he created for himself. This is Holmes talking. My mind rebels at stagnation. Give me problems. Give me work. Give me the most abstruse cryptogram or the most intricate analysis, and I'm in my own proper atmosphere. I can dispense then with artificial stimulants. But I abhor the dull routine of existence. I crave for mental exaltation. That is why I've chosen my own particular profession, or rather created it, for I'm the only one in the world.
Well, let's talk a little more about that scientific mind. There's a scene in which Watson and Holmes first meet. Holmes is conducting scientific experiments. They're introduced in the room. And Holmes says, how are you? Gripping Watson's hand. And then says, you've been in Afghanistan, I perceive. How did you know? Watson asks. Mm-hmm. Never mind, said Holmes. How did he know?
The train of reasoning ran, here's a gentleman of a medical type, but with the air of a military man. He's just come from the tropics. His face is dark. His wrists are fair, so that's not the natural tint of his skin. He's undergone hardship and sickness because Watson was injured in Afghanistan. His haggard face says that clearly. His arm has been injured. Where in the tropics could an English army doctor have seen such hardship and got his arm wounded? Clearly in Afghanistan.
Tell us a little more about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's writing. We understand he created Sherlock Holmes in a couple of novels and a number of short stories. And then he killed him off, and people went in a mourning.
I think he sort of felt trapped by this creation because in the initial stories, Holmes was really kind of this one-dimensional character who didn't have a lot of light or shadow. And Doyle felt like, well, I'm a better writer than this. You know, I don't want to be stuck writing this sort of calculating machine my whole life. So he kills him off. In The Adventure of the Final Problem, he tumbles over the edge of a waterfall with his nemesis, Dr. Moriarty, and that's, you know, the last we're going to see of him, it's implied. He got nasty letters, and there were, you know, impromptu protests, and he stood up to it for a long time. He got a lot of pressure to bring Holmes back. Finally, he writes The Hound of the Baskervilles, and everyone's excited, and then they realize that it's sort of written posthumously as a story that took place before he'd fallen off the waterfall. Then it was only years later that he finally, you know, brought Holmes back and came to have many more adventures, and I think became a more three-dimensional, interesting character with flaws and all sorts of human aspects.
Well, you mentioned some of the shows that Sherlock Holmes begat, including House. The creators of House have acknowledged that the doctor at the center who has to solve a medical mystery every program is based on Holmes.
That's right. And there are all sorts of little playful clues that they embed in the show that relate back to Holmes. You know, just the name House, Holmes are similar. His friend is Dr. Wilson. Dr. Watson. I think they were roommates at one point. Mm-hmm. House plays the piano and the guitar. Holmes plays the violin. House is addicted to pills. Holmes is addicted to cocaine.
Well, and what about Sherlock Holmes and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's impact as well on real investigations and real detectives? Did that really have an impact?
I think in retrospect, it did. In terms of Holmes employing all these scientific methods in his detective work, he was very much ahead of his time, and the brilliance of his methodology is studied today by, you know, people in criminal justice programs and detective departments and things like that.
Well, and we note in your book that Arthur Conan Doyle said in his autobiography that there was something of a real Sherlock Holmes. His teacher, Joe Bell?
That's right. Arthur Conan Doyle was a medical student, and he had a professor, Joseph Bell, who would constantly amaze his students by coming up with these amazing deductions. He would bring someone into the class who had some malady, and he was sort of a medical detective, almost like the House character. And he would say, you know, okay, this woman, she would speak four words, and he would say, she's from this town, she works at this place, she has two children, and she got here via this route. And, you know, people would say, how do you know that? And he would go through this blow-by-blow series of deductions that really read exactly like something Sherlock Holmes would say. Well, she had dirt on her feet that could only come from this path, and her accent is such and such from this town. And, you know, in many ways, the Bell character, even physically, the shape of his face, he had this long nose and, you know, these piercing eyes, resembled Sherlock Holmes.
Fascinating stuff. That's Ransom Riggs. Yes, that's his real name. And he's the author of the book, The Sherlock Holmes Handbook. Ransom, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Welcome back. We think we have the perfect soundtrack for this day. Music from an ancient wooden horn called the Serpent. The Serpent was invented in Renaissance France as a substitute for the church organ. It can sound mellow, or it can sound like this. Serpents live up to their name. They're carved in a crazy S shape. They used to be very popular, but they fell out of favor when brass horns came along, partly because with only finger holes and no keys, serpents are notoriously hard to keep in tune. But it's not difficult for Douglas Yeo. He plays all 26 serpent parts you're hearing right now. He's one of several hundred serpent players in the world. He's also a bass trombonist for the Boston Symphony Orchestra. When we spoke with him last year, he brought two small serpents to the studio, and I asked him where he keeps the one that he owns, a 16-foot-long serpent called the anaconda.
In my basement, and I have to say, I do feed it small mammals now and then to keep it happy.
It looks like a snake. I mean, is it ever frightening to people to see it?
Well, I think more than frightening, it's an eye-opener. because it is, I think, of all instruments ever invented in music history, certainly one of the most visually arresting in sort of a double S shape. It's something that really gets people's eyes popping out and wondering, gee, now I wonder what that sounds like.
What does that sound like? Well, let's hear. Why don't you give us a little toot? While I describe it, it sort of looks like black. I'm thinking of a Drano commercial. It can look like drain pipe.
Yes, we've heard those jokes too.
I'm sorry. Or, you know, it looks like something you'd see in a Dr. Seuss book.
Indeed.
But it is, what is that? Is that leather now, the
yes.
black that's...
This instrument that I'm holding was made for me in 1996, and it's made of walnut, covered then with leather, and it ends in a metal bocal or metal tube that goes to the mouthpiece. And the mouthpiece is made, this particular one is historical mouthpiece made of ivory, and sometimes they were made of wood as well. And it's a mouthpiece that's very much like a trombone mouthpiece, which is one of the reasons why I was particularly attracted to it. And so while it is an instrument made of wood, it's considered a brass-type instrument.
And by the way, is that one piece of wood carved like that with all the different curves?
Actually, two pieces and then glued together.
Huh. Let's listen to this one just to get a little
sure.
sound. Playing that, because we see there are some holes, some openings like on a wooden flute.
Yes.
But no keys, no valve. So how are you?
Right. Well, the serpent being 8 feet long and my having only two hands, the instrument had to be made in such a way where a player's fingers could actually reach the holes to change the notes. These three holes for each hand are not necessarily in the best place to get the best quality notes. So you have good notes in the serpent, and you have more challenging notes to produce that you really have to wrestle into shape with your face, with your embouchure, with your lips.
How hard is that physically to play it?
It is a challenge. My good friend Phil Humphreys, who plays in a group called the Mellstock Band in England, is known to look at his serpent in the morning and say, "And what kind of mood are you in today?" Because, of course, being a modern trombone player, my trombone is perfectly made. It's made of brass. It's machine-tooled. This was all made by hand. My other serpent that I have here was made almost 200 years ago in France. Mm. It's a very different feel than my modern trombone. When I hold this historic serpent, I'm aware that I am only the latest owner of it in a 200-year-long stream of serpent players. I have no idea where this instrument was used. I bought it in Paris. Huh. So we just don't know. But there is definitely a connection that I have with the instrument.
Well, as a matter of fact, if you wouldn't mind, you're holding the one that has recently been made for you. Would you mind exchanging it for this older 200-year-old serpent? And so, you know, when you say that it was like playing a living thing, all I can think of as I watch you, and maybe this helps the listeners, is in Alice in Wonderland where she plays croquet with a flamingo
yes.
as a mallet.
Yes.
You're trying to keep the head down. That's sort of what you look like.
Yes, I do. I tell people that when I sit over the serpent, I'm a bit like a praying mantis around it. I have it between my knees like a cello player, but it's actually the holes are rather awkwardly drilled, so you can't just kind of comfortably put your arms around it. You have to sort of sit at a position where you're
kind of hunched forward,
kind of at attention with it, and then play. After all, it is French.
Well, this is awkward. Shouldn't we stand?
Indeed.
Oh, it's quite something. How'd you start this?
Well, it was really curiosity that led me to it. I was in the Tanglewood Library looking at music for the following season in the summer of 1994 and saw a piece by Berlioz, his Messe Solennelle. Hector Berlioz.
Yes.
Loved by all serpent players because he wrote for the serpent in at least two of his pieces. And I saw that we were playing this newly discovered mass and had a serpent part. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I did go to the Boston Symphony personnel manager and say to him, "I'm going to play the serpent on the Berlioz Mass." And he said, "The heck you are. You're going to have to audition that for Seiji," which, of course, was Seiji Ozawa.
Yeah.
Seiji was captivated by it. He thought it had a lot of personality. And I played it in the Berlioz Mass. And one thing led to another. And I began to embark on this evangelistic effort on behalf of helping the serpent's image, which had taken a hit by the time it went extinct in the late 1800s.
Well, and part of the hit came from Hector Berlioz, because, yes, while he wrote music for the serpent, this is what he later wrote about the instrument. The truly barbaric tone of this instrument would be much better suited for the bloody cult of the Druids than for that of the Catholic Church, for whom he'd been writing the sacred music. With the exception, he noted, of Masses for the Dead, where its cold and awful blaring is doubtless appropriate. Well, why did he turn on the serpent?
Well, I mean, I listen to that quotation and I just say, ouch. You know, because by the time Berlioz was writing, playing standards for the serpent were in decline. Already, players were not grappling with the particular challenges that the instrument has in terms of playing in tune, and it was falling out of favor.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Douglas Yeo and listening to a track from his CD, Le Monde du Serpent. Douglas, there's a story I'd love you to share about how serpent music can soothe the soul. Like a snake charmer, you once calmed a customs agent at Logan Airport.
Yes, what? That's true. Well, when I came back from England in 1996 with the new serpent that Keith Rogers had made for me, I knew that I would have to pay import duty on it because it's not an antique. So I went to the items to declare line, and the customs agent looked at me and said, "What do you have there?" I said, "I have a serpent." It got quiet, and he said, "Why don't you come over here?" And he drew a curtain around, and he said, "Take it out." And I took it out, and then he said, "Play it." So I took it out and put it together and started playing it, and everything got very quiet in the baggage area. You know, then I played maybe for 3 or 4 minutes, and I stopped, and I looked at him, and he said, "No duty. That was lovely." So there you go.
It soothes the soul. Serpent player Douglas Yeo. He's also bass trombonist for the Boston Symphony Orchestra and a member of the faculty at the New England Conservatory. We spoke with him last year.